A more detailed account of the deal that Dick cut, unquote, comes from the person referred to in the Christopher Hitchens article, namely Barbara Honecker. Research credit for, well, this article was also provided to us by Mabe Russell. And this is from In These Times, issue of June 24th, 1987. This is an article by Barbara Honecker, again, H-O-N-E-G-G-E-R, with Jim Norekas, N-A-U-R-E-C-K-A-S. It's headlined, Did Reagan Steal the 1980 Election? And in an introduction to the article, much of the evidence presented here has been previously reported, but the pieces are being put together for the first time by freelance investigative writer Barbara Honecker. She worked in the national headquarters of the 1980 Reagan campaign, and after the election was rewarded with a post as a policy analyst at the White House, where she served until 1982. She brings to her exhaustive research an inside understanding of the Reagan campaign. Honecker knew firsthand the campaign's anxious atmosphere, which may have led Reagan aides to negotiate with Iran, not to secure the hostages' release, but to make sure they stayed in their captors' hands until after the election. In These Times, staff writer Jim Norekas collaborated with Honecker on the following article. The article itself begins, In October of 1980, nothing worried the Reagan campaign so much as the possibility that the 52 hostages held by Iran might come home. The Reagan camp feared that the public perception of President Carter's weakness would evaporate if he could win the captives' release before the election, what Reagan staffers called an October surprise, unquote. But in the campaign's closing weeks, the mood of high anxiety suddenly changed. In late October, Barbara Honecker was working as a researcher for the campaign's Arlington, Virginia national headquarters. We don't have to worry about an October surprise, a jubilant staffer at the campaign's operations center told her. Dick cut a deal. Unquote. Dick was Richard Allen, Reagan's chief foreign policy advisor. And the deal, researched by In These Times suggests, was an agreement that Reagan would guarantee post-elections arms shipments to Iran in exchange for delaying the hostages' release until after the November 4th election. Why would the Reagan campaign seek such a seemingly incredible arrangement? Because it saw an October surprise as the campaign's number one threat. In late fall, surveys still found the election too close to call. Reagan's top pollster, Richard Wortlandt, predicted that a pre-election hostage release would boost Carter at least 5 or 6 percentage points in the polls, and as much as 10%, giving him a sure victory if the release came before the campaign's final week. The Reagan revolution would be over before it had begun.
Continuing, Operation October Surprise. Reagan's election effort was headed by campaign manager William Casey, who later became CIA director, and Chief of Staff Edwin Meese III, now Reagan's Attorney General. Casey, Meese, and other top Reagan aides met for 30 minutes each morning to discuss the hostage situation, according to journalists Jack Germond and Jules Whitcover. Germond and Whitcover wrote that the campaign anticipated the October surprise with a, quote, trepidation bordering on paranoia, unquote. Casey and Meese named Allen to head a 10-man October surprise group, whose purpose, the New York Times wrote on October 7, 1980, was, quote, the guessing of possible Carter moves and the formulation of counter moves to preserve Mr. Reagan's current lead in the polls, unquote. Let me just read that phrase again. This is self-admitted from the New York Times at that very moment that this stuff was going on. This was published in the paper. Think about this in light of this being, on one hand, a government action being carried out by a sitting president, and the other camp being a political campaign. The October Surprise Group's purpose was, quote, the guessing of possible Carter moves and the formulation of counter moves to preserve Mr. Reagan's current lead in the polls, unquote. The group included soon-to-be Reagan officials like Fred E. Clay, now Undersecretary of Defense, and John Layman, who served as Reagan's Navy Secretary. The group's activities were part of what Casey described to reporters as the campaign's, quote, intelligence operation. It was investigated in 1983 by a congressional subcommittee chaired by Representative Donald Al Bosta, Democrat from Michigan, after reports surfaced that Reagan had prepared for the October 28, 1980 debate by using materials stolen from the Carter campaign. In May 1984, the committee released two-volume, 2,413-page Al Bosta report titled, quote, Unauthorized Transfers of Non-Public Information During the 1980 Election. The report details the campaign's inner workings and includes dozens of confidential memos. But coming out at the height of Reagan's popularity, the report received little media attention and was quickly forgotten. The Alboster report established that Admiral Robert Garrick, the campaign's, quote, research and policy development director, arranged for retired military officers to gather intelligence on U.S. aircraft movements that could indicate a forthcoming hostage release. Shortly before the election, Meese wrote a confidential staff memo saying that Garrick would be working full-time on, quote, activities relating to our response to the hostage issue, unquote. To continue with In These Times.
Again. Garrick also set up an operations center, unquote, in Arlington, Virginia, run by Stephen Halper, director of policy coordination. The center supposedly monitored news, but the memos written by Halper to Meese, uncovered by the Alboster investigation, all dealt with internal Carter campaign matters. One of Halper's top officers, Robert Gambino, was formerly the CIA's director of security and had been George Bush's bodyguard during his campaign for the Republican presidential nomination. The other officers at the operations center, Davis Robinson, Michael Smith, and Moncrief Spears, were also veterans of the Bush campaign, which had extensive intelligence contacts from Bush's 1976-77 tenure as CIA chief. The campaign's intelligence efforts paid off. Reagan public relations aide Peter Hannaford wrote in The Reagans, A Political Portrait, that in late September of 1980, quote, the Reagan camp's intelligence detected that the Carter White House was negotiating for the release of the American captives in Iran, unquote, and in fact, the Carter administration was talking to Iran about freeing the hostages before November 4th, according to the memoirs of Carter administration officials. On October 15, 1980, Allen, as head of the October Surprise Group, sent a memo to Reagan and his closest advisors warning that a hostage release could come before the election like a bolt from the blue, unquote, because of Iranian President Abolhassan Banisadr's desire to rid himself of the hostage crisis. You are probably safe for this week and maybe even next week, a source told John Wallach, a reporter friendly to the Reagan campaign, according to Allen's memo. Surprises could happen at the end of the month, unquote. Allen later said that the source was Carter's Secretary of State, Edmund Muskie. Remember Edmund Muskie? He, of course, was a third member of the Tower Commission. The man with no name. About this time, Allen took part in an extraordinary meeting first revealed by Bob Woodward and Walter Pincus in the Washington Post on November 29, 1986, and reported more fully by Alfonso Chardy in the Miami Herald last April 12. According to the Herald, Allen, his aide Lawrence Silberman, and Robert McFarlane, then working for Senator John Tower, Republican of Texas, on the Senate Armed Services Committee, met with, quote, a man who said he represented the Iranian government, unquote, in early October 1980. The Post described the envoy as an Iranian exile, unquote. I would interrupt, that would, incidentally, fit the Cyrus Hashemi description, obviously not definitive, but worth taking note of. The Post described the envoy as an Iranian exile, unquote. According to the Herald, he made this offer to Reagan's men. Iran would release the hostages to Reagan, not Carter, in order to ensure President Carter's defeat in the November election, unquote. Both Allen and McFarlane went on to become national security advisors, from which post McFarlane would be responsible for the 1985 secret arms for hostages negotiations with Iran. Silberman was appointed to the federal judiciary by Reagan. McFarlane told the Herald he arranged the secret meeting, which took place in a Washington hotel. Quote, an individual claiming to be Iranian approached me and was referred to the Reagan campaign staff, he said. McFarlane, Allen, and Silberman all told the Herald that they rejected the offer of a hostage deal between the Reagan campaign and Iran. I said to him, we have one president at a time, Silberman said. Allen claimed that he wrote up minutes of the meeting but later lost them. And all three men maintained that they couldn't remember the name of the person they met with. I would interrupt again. That seems a little unusual that all three of them would suffer such a memory loss, given the import of the event.
All right, continuing. But the events that followed in the last weeks of October 1980 raised doubts that the deal was dismissed. In his October debate with Carter, Reagan responded to charges that he had a, quote, secret plan for the hostages by saying that his ideas involved, quote, quiet diplomacy, where you don't say in advance or say to anyone what it is you're thinking of doing. And on October 30th, according to journalist Roland Perry, Casey dismissed the danger of a hostage release, saying that if something happened to give Carter the election, quote, it won't be the hostages. Casey, of course, turned out to be right. The Iranians, who once planned to release the hostages before the election, held on to them until long after their release could help Carter. And between October 11th and October 22nd, the Iranians significantly changed their bargaining position. Earlier in the month, according to Carter's National Security Council expert on Iran, Gary Sick, Iran had insisted on receiving American weapons and spare parts paid for by the Shah. But Sick's book, All Fall Down, reports that by October 22nd, Iran had specifically limited its demands to cash assets frozen in the U.S., despite the desperate need for spare parts caused by the September 22nd Iraqi invasion. Such a shift makes sense if Iran knew it would have access to U.S.-made arms under a Reagan administration. Carter's account of his presidency, Keeping Faith, notes that, quote, hardliners in Iran blocked his final efforts to reach an agreement before the election. And Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, wrote in his memoirs, quote, our hopes for a positive resolution for the hostage issue were dashed in late October, unquote. On November 4th, the anniversary of the embassy takeover, the hostages were still in Tehran, and Reagan was elected by a wide margin. After the election, Carter finalized a hostage agreement with Iran on favorable terms. No military goods were shipped to Iran, and the U.S. returned only $4 billion of Iran's $12 billion that had been frozen since the crisis began. The hostages remained in captivity until January 20, 1981, the day Reagan took the oath of office, and they left Tehran minutes after he became president. Bonnie Sauter told the Miami Herald that Iranian officials had, quote, closely coordinated the hostage release with Reagan aides, whose names Bonnie Sauter did not know. One of the Iranians, according to Bonnie Sauter, was Ali Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, speaker of the Iranian parliament, seen by Carter negotiators as a, quote, hardliner. Rafsanjani later negotiated the 1985 Arms for Hostages deal with McFarlane. The hostage release and upbeat beginning for Reagan's presidency developed a hitch. The unresolved question of Cynthia Dwyer, a journalist arrested by Iran in May 1980 who was not released with the other hostages. In a November 7, 1986 interview on the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour, Allen said Reagan had taken a tough line on Dwyer with the Iranians. Quote, get the word out that the deal is off unless she's on the plane, Allen said Reagan had told him. But Reagan could not have called off Carter's hostage deal since Carter had already transferred the $4 billion in frozen funds he had promised Iran. Reagan may have been making an empty threat, but he also could have been referring to a separate deal. Perhaps the deal the Iranian, singular, offered to Allen, Reagan's top foreign policy advisor, that candidate Reagan had worked out with Iran through, quote, quiet diplomacy. Dwyer was released on February 9, 1981, after newly named Secretary of State Alexander Haig said that the outcome of her case would affect U.S. policy toward Iran.
Continuing. In 1981, Iran began receiving U.S.-made weapons, arms that may have been a quid pro quo for delaying the hostages' release. The Reagan administration would have faced a problem in upholding its end of a pre-election bargain with Iran. It would be politically impossible to directly supply arms to anti-American Iran. But Reagan had several alternative channels available, including the global network of private arms dealers and the U.S.'s most reliable ally, Israel. Like the 1985's arms shipments that ransom hostages held in Lebanon, the arms shipped to Iran in 1981 came from Israel, which was required to get prior U.S. approval to sell U.S.-made weapons to third countries. Israel would be the natural intermediary to secretly supply Iran with arms, since the U.S. often uses Israel to supply weapons to countries the U.S. prefers not to arm directly, such as South Africa, Somoza's Nicaragua, and Guatemala under military rule. Israel's defense minister at the time of the 1981 shipments to Iran, General Ariel Sharon, told the Washington Post a year later that the U.S. had been informed of the arms going to Iran and had expressed no objections. The Washington Post reported on November 29, 1986, that Secretary of State Haig gave Israel permission to ship $10 million to $15 million worth of U.S. arms to Iran in 1981. The Post wrote that a key advocate of this plan, which violated stated administration policy, was McFarlane, who had just joined the State Department as a counselor to Haig. The Post reported that these shipments had earlier been discussed by Allen and Morris Amite, an American lobbyist for Israel, in late 1980. This was presumably after Allen's meeting with the Iranian representative.
Others involved in approving the Israeli shipments of U.S.-made weapons were Michael Ledeen, who was working for McFarlane, and Richard Secord, who was then the Assistant Secretary of Defense with responsibility for the Mideast. But the arms shipments from Israel may... The arms shipments from Israel may have been something military supplies Iran received from private arms dealers, maybe only in addition to or only part of. Despite official prohibitions against military sales to Iran, quote, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of U.S.-made military equipment continues to flow to Iran each year, unquote, through private sources, Time magazine reported on July 25, 1983. Several of these arms flows are documented in the National Security Archive's chronology of the Iran-Contra scandal. European Defense Associates, for example, was set up in 1983 to supply Iran with up to $1 billion in advanced weaponry. The company was founded by Colonel Ralph Broman, head of the Pentagon's Office of Defense Cooperation in Paris, and a former CIA officer named Paul Cutter. When the deal was exposed in 1987, Cutter told the New York Times, quote, "We all worked under the umbrella of Defense Department approval." By the way, in quotes, I should say, we've talked about the Cutter case before. He's also known as Paul Saklosha. Continuing, the Reagan administration gave at least tacit approval to these arms sales. Quote, "The U.S. has shown little zeal in enforcing the ban on arms sales to Iran," unquote, Time wrote in 1983. The U.S. government did not make serious attempts to halt private sale of U.S. arms to Iran until after it had begun direct arms negotiations with Iran in 1985. If the Reagan administration approved these weapons shipments, as private arms dealers have charged, then Iran profited greatly by delaying the hostages' release until after Reagan had been elected. In 1980, according to SICK, Carter's negotiators only offered Iran $50 million worth of non-lethal spare parts already paid for by the Shah, withholding those weapons that were, quote, technologically sensitive and or of high lethality, unquote. But since Reagan took office, Iran has received hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, worth of high-tech U.S. weaponry, enough to carry its war with Iraq into its seventh year. Yet shipments of U.S.-made arms to Iran before 1985 were ignored by the president's hand-picked Iran scandal investigators, the Tower Commission. Tower, the commission's head, was McFarlane's boss at the time of his October 1980 meeting with the Iranian, as well as Reagan's campaign chief in Texas. McFarlane also worked for Brent Scowcroft, another member of the commission, when Scowcroft was President Ford's national security advisor. The board's token Democrat was Muskie, Carter's Secretary of State, who, according to Allen, passed vital information about the hostage negotiations to a journalist friendly to the Reagan camp.
And one piece of information that we're going to look at in the cover-up programs, which is not mentioned there, is that Brent Scowcroft is also the vice president of Kissinger Associates, Henry Kissinger's very, very powerful international consulting firm. So it's a very, very tight little commission indeed. McFarlane was working for Tower at the time of this deal, and Tower also worked for Brent Scowcroft. Brent Scowcroft now works for Henry Kissinger. Ed Muskie was the guy who apparently, at least according to Allen, helped pass information to him concerning the inner workings of the Carter administration in this regard. It should also be noted, too, as we'll touch on in the cover-up section, Ed Muskie is also a key member of the Council on Foreign Relations, a group heavily influenced by the Rockefellers, going back to the drain on Chase Manhattan and the Rockefeller-Kissinger pressure to get the Shah admitted, resulting in the hostage taking, as everybody knew, as we indicated. So again, we're going to take a break now and come back, and we'll sum a little bit of this up, and then we're going to plunge on still further with the final section of the broadcast. But I think the overall outline of the machinations, it wasn't the administration at the time that the Reagan campaign was involved in, are becoming clear. And again, the extent to which this administration, which came in decrying terrorism, has in fact thrived, established itself in the first place and perpetuated itself through the deliberate strategic manipulation of the terrorism it pretends to be so opposed to, I think is becoming clear. It will become clearer in the third section of the broadcast, or the final section of the broadcast.
All right, and with that, we are going to take a break. We will be back in a few minutes for the last part of Radio Free America with Dave Emery, myself, Nip Tuck. And we are getting the last bits and pieces here together. So while Dave is grabbing his stuff, I'm grabbing my stuff. What was that you just heard? A couple of nice things. How sweet to be off of an album of his called The Same Thing, the eponymous, whatever it is. Yeah, eponymous album. Titled the same. Anyway, so we're back and we are going to finish up. We've been talking about, we just finished reading a long article from In These Times featuring the wisdom of Barbara Honegger, former member of the Reagan team, who was talking about the sabotaging or the possible sabotaging of the hostage rescue attempts, or more specifically about the hostage release efforts in general, including negotiations to have the hostages released. But they're sabotaged by the Reagan campaign operations team, which is, in fact, as we have been talking about tonight, part of a larger team that we're calling, for the sake of brevity and clarity, well, brevity, yes, clarity, no, that we're calling the secret team. And people like William Casey and Richard Allen and others have long since had running connections with Secord, Kleins, Shackley, Wilson, Turple et al. And this was one situation where apparently these connections proved quite useful to the Reagan administration.
We're going to take a look now at a couple of other strategic uses of, terrorism or terrorist figures. In the first case here, Muammar Gaddafi, at manipulation, again, strategic manipulation of terrorism and terrorist figures to essentially destabilize, well, to influence U.S. electoral results. Returning again to the defeat of Jimmy Carter in 1980, we're going to return very briefly to something which we took a look at considerable length in our Mediterranean Merry-Go-Round series, our five-part series about who shot the Pope. The individual concerned here is Michael Ledeen, the scam we're going to be focusing on primarily, Michael Ledeen's breaking of the story about the association between Billy Carter and Muammar Gaddafi of Libya, again, by way of illustrating the strategic use of terrorism to destabilize the Carter campaign. Reading now from the San Francisco Examiner from Sunday, February 1st of 1987. This is a story by Lewis Traeger of the Examiner. It reads, it's headlined, Report Names New Key Connection in Iran Arms Scandal. And it reads as follows. A part-time government consultant emerges from a new congressional report as a central figure in the Iran arms sale affair. The prominence may be new for Michael Ledeen, but he has been injecting himself into international scandals for years. Ledeen, quote, appears to have played a key role in the initial contacts between the U.S. and Israel, unquote, on Iran, the Senate Intelligence Committee said Thursday in a report on its investigation of the unfolding scandal. The committee placed the genesis of the arms deals in 1984 and showed that Ledeen played a far heavier role than previously reported. Ledeen sold President Reagan's national security advisor on U.S.-Israeli-Iranian contacts in May of 1985, the report said. It added that throughout 1985, Ledeen served as a main U.S. representative in talks that led to the secret arms sales to Iran. The sales were aimed, at least in part, at freeing U.S. hostages in Lebanon. Some of the proceeds were diverted to supporters of Nicaraguan rebels. From his base at a hawkish think tank in Washington, Ledeen, 45, has been a hardline supporter of many anti-communist causes. He has been an outspoken opponent of the Soviet Union and the left-wing government of Nicaragua, and a strong backer of Israel and the late Shah of Iran. He also has made himself into a player in political intelligence controversies, from Billy Carter's dealings with Libya to the assassination attempt of Pope John Paul II. Skipping down on the story, Ledeen is an object of fascination to others, partly because of a long line of intriguing associations. Quote, I understand that Michael travels in interesting circles and gets to meet a lot of people, the former Intelligence Committee Chairman Senator David Durenberger, Republican of Minnesota, has said. Ledeen has been a foreign policy consultant to top Reagan administration officials off and on since 1981. He works out of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a think tank. His colleagues there have included Arnaud de Borgrave, a sometime writing collaborator with Ledeen and editor of the Mooney's Washington Times newspaper, and David Abshire, Reagan's new special counselor on the Iran-Contra affair. Before the current scandal, Ledeen was probably best known as a leading advocate of the view that Soviet bloc intelligence agencies were behind the 1981 assassination attempt of Pope John Paul II. That theory was generally discredited last year when the central witness, gunman Mehmet Ali Azhar, declared himself Jesus Christ and offered to raise the dead. Ledeen often writes media reports critical of both the U.S. administration and international terrorism for conservative publications such as Commentary and The New Republic. During the 1980 campaign, Ledeen and de Borgrave broke the scandal about the dealings of President Carter's brother Billy with Libya. A former official of an Italian spy agency said he provided the information to the authors, but Ledeen has declined to discuss the matter. Interjecting, that former Italian intelligence officer is Francesco Pazienza, involved in, among other things, the P2 Lodge, lurking around the attempt on the life of Pope John Paul II, and a number of other things. We'll be touching back on some of those Mediterranean merry-go-round connections in our next program on the subject. This will be on September 13th, 2 weeks from this evening. Ledeen has acknowledged to the Wall Street Journal that he worked for an Italian spy agency as a consultant in the early 1980s. But Friday, he would say only that he did, quote, banal and routine research for the Italian government. His friend, Theodore Shackley, was an intelligence person, unquote. In 1982, Shackley, a former CIA official, came under investigation in an $8 million overbilling of the Pentagon in an arms shipment to Egypt. Ledeen interviewed with the prosecutor according to the recent book Manhunt by Peter Maas. The book quoted Ledeen as saying that if Shackley was involved, the money might have gone to a covert operation. So the Ledeen-Pazienza Association on the Billy Carter story, the Billy Carter connections to Gaddafi, is worth noting here. Again, indications of the manipulation of terrorism or terrorists to destabilize the Carter campaign and, in effect, overthrow United States law.
Now we're going to talk about another deal that was being made on the eve of another election, this being the Senate and House elections of 1986. The article is from the San Jose Mercury News for Friday, June 5, 1987. Headline, Hakim said he was told Reagan okayed plan for election eve hostage release. The article is by R.A. Zaldivar and Charles Green of the Mercury Washington Bureau. I should just mention again, I know this will sound silly to all the hardcore listeners, but I want to make a quick distinction between Cyrus Hashemi and Albert Hakim, since they're both Middle Eastern names, sound somewhat similar. Albert Hakim is the middleman in the officially acknowledged arms for hostages deal between the Reagan administration and Iran. Hakim worked here in the Bay Area with, among other people, Secord. And Ed Wilson, among others. But anyway, the other man, Cyrus Hashemi, is the one who is currently dead and probably will stay that way, who was involved in one other arms shipment to Iran and we think might possibly have been the man who came with the October surprise message from the Iranian government.
That's certainly a hypothesis. We think he might be.
Anyway, reading from the article, again, headline, Hakim says he was told Reagan okayed plan for hostage release, election eve. Dateline Washington. Iran-Contra money man Albert Hakim testified Thursday that Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North delegated him to broker an election eve arms for hostages deal in which the Reagan administration would help free 17 terrorists charged with bombing the U.S. and French embassies in Kuwait. Hakim also said North, then a National Security Council aide, told him in October that President Reagan had approved the plan. In testimony that shed new light on the secret White House opening to Iran, Hakim also said that he had discussed the need to pay bribes to Iranian officials with North, who approved in principle. Hakim, an Iranian-American businessman from Los Gatos who was the operation's financial middleman, said North left him alone to negotiate with Iranian officials after an October 1986 meeting in Frankfurt, West Germany. North wanted the five U.S. hostages being held by Muslim fundamentalists in Beirut home before Election Day, and left the meeting to return to Washington after the Iranians told him they couldn't deliver, Hakim said. He said North told him he had 6 hours to save the deal. Quote, "The subject of the election was definitely discussed," said Hakim. "He wanted to gain the release of the hostages to enhance the position of the president," unquote. At the time, Reagan was campaigning full-time in an ultimately unsuccessful effort to preserve a Republican majority in the U.S. Senate. The deal resulted in the shipment of 500 TOW anti-tank missiles from the United States to Iran in exchange for the release of hostage David Jacobson on November 2nd. The 17 terrorists, held in connection with the December 12, 1983 bombing of the U.S. and French embassies there that killed 4 and wounded 87, were not freed, and Secretary of State George Shultz later repudiated any such deal.
And once again, we see something which at this point is sort of a numbing pattern, but using the hostage situation in such a way as to manipulate U.S. electoral results. Again, that would seem perhaps almost hackneyed at this juncture, but it's worth noting that this has been a key feature of this administration even before it was an administration. The final section of our broadcast this evening is going to take a look at something even more sinister that developed out of this October surprise group, namely a contingency plan to declare martial law in the United States and suspend the Constitution. One of the things that's worth noting about this is this contingency plan was being developed in response to a number of different possibilities, including terrorism, unquote, in the United States by alleged Central American terrorists infiltrating along with illegal refugees from Latin America. Another possibility would be widespread public opposition to a U.S. military adventure abroad. One of the things we looked at the tail end of our last Radio Free America on this subject, Radio Free America number 30, was not only the involvement of the Turpa Wilson team, according to the Christic Institute, in the Lapenka bombing, but a plan to blow up the U.S. Embassy to Costa Rica, killing the U.S. ambassador, blaming that on the Sandinistas, using that as an excuse to invade Nicaragua. It is a safe bet that in such an eventuality, there would be widespread widespread protests against the military venture in the United States. The Reagan administration was prepared to suspend the Constitution and declare martial law in response to this. And again, the massive contacts between the Reagan administration and terrorists and the Triple Wilson team in particular, we took a look at it in our last program. We're going to be taking a look at it in Radio Free America number 32, the third of our programs on the terror connections to the Iran-Contra scandal. Word about this martial law plan was broken, again, by that same excellent reporter who works for both he writes for the Miami Herald. All his stories are also accessed in the San Jose Mercury News. Reading now from the San Jose Mercury News of Sunday morning, July 5th of 1987. This is a story by Alfonso Chardi, headlined, North and the Secret Government, subheaded Martial Law Plan Among Work of Reagan Advisors, Dateline, Washington. Marine Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North helped draft a plan in 1984 to impose martial law in the United States in the event of an emergency, inspiring a sharp protest by then-Attorney General William French Smith, according to government officials. The secret plan called for suspension of the Constitution, turning control of the government over to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, appointment of military commanders to run state and local governments, and the declaration of martial law in the event of such a crisis as a nuclear war, violent and widespread internal dissent, or national opposition to a U.S. military invasion abroad. North's involvement in a proposal to radically alter American government by executive order in a time of crisis is evidence that he was involved in a wide range of secret activities, foreign and domestic, far beyond the Iran-Contra affair, according to officials. The chief counsel of the Senate Iran-Contra Committee has declared in an unreleased memo that North was at the center of what amounted to a secret government within a government, unquote. Skipping down on the story, the contingency plan was being written as part of an executive order or legislative package that Reagan would sign and hold within the National Security Council until such time as a severe crisis arose, an administration official said. It is not known whether Reagan signed the plan. Investigators now believe that from 1983 to 86, North's office in the old executive office building adjacent to the White House was the heart of an informal secret structure involved in far more than the sale of arms to Iran and the funding of the undercover war in Nicaragua. North's influence within the secret structure was so great, the sources said, that he was able to have the orbits of sophisticated surveillance satellites altered to follow Soviet ships around the world, call for the launching of high-flying spy aircraft on secret missions over Cuba and Nicaragua, and become involved in sensitive domestic activities. Some of Reagan's closest friends and advisors, including former National Security Advisor William Clark, the late CIA Director William Casey, and Attorney General Edwin Meese, were part of that informal secret structure, according to several congressional investigators and government officials. Skipping down still further. But according to the sources, the administration's propensity for secret activities may have had its beginnings in an October 1980 decision by Casey, then Reagan's campaign manager, to create a so-called October surprise group to monitor President Jimmy Carter's feverish negotiations with Iran for the release of 52 American hostages. The group, led by former campaign policy advisor Richard Allen, was founded out of concern that Carter might pull off an October surprise, unquote, such as a last-minute deal for release of the hostages before the November 4th election. One of the group's first acts was a meeting with a man who claimed to represent Iran and who offered to release the hostages to Reagan. Allen and another campaign aide, Lawrence Silberman, in April, told the Miami Herald of the meeting and said that McFarlane, then a Senate Armed Services Committee aide, arranged and attended it. McFarlane later became Reagan's national security advisor and in 1986 played a key role in the Iran-Contra affair. Allen and Silberman said the offer, which they said they rejected, was aimed at ensuring Reagan's victory. Congressional investigators now link another well-known campaign incident, the theft of confidential briefing materials from Carter's campaign before the October 28, 1980 Carter-Reagan debate, to the same secret group. The investigators now believe that Casey somehow obtained the materials used to brief Reagan on what Carter was likely to say, and passed them to James Baker, another top Reagan campaign aide who in Reagan's first term served as White House Chief of Staff. That last section obviously is by way of review for a number of different articles that we read this evening. It should be noted that out of this group grew the Martial Law Plan. And this plan for establishing martial law in the United States was termed in the Christic Institute affidavit, well, it actually was termed Rex 84. And a good account of the Rex 84 Martial Law Plan was in, or is presented in the affidavit by Daniel Sheehan of the Christic Institute.
Reading from the Christic Institute and the Christic Institute's Sheehan affidavit. Sheehan writes as follows: at the end of March of 1984, I communicated to sources 4, 5, and 6, and 7 the information communicated to me earlier in March by Protestant ministers, source number 1. And I asked them to ascertain for me the source of this accusation that the Catholic Church participants in the sanctuary movement were somehow involved in smuggling into the United States, quote, known communist terrorists, unquote, unquote, who planned to form themselves once inside the U.S. into, quote, military cadres to undertake the launching of military assaults against U.S. military installations, domestic communication centers, and domestic water resource systems. In the event that President Reagan deemed it necessary to initiate direct military action by U.S. forces in Central America, either in El Salvador or in Nicaragua. During the second week of April of 1984, I was informed by Source 4 that President Ronald Reagan had, on April 6, 1984, issued National Security Decision Directive No. 52, authorizing Federal Emergency Management Agency Director Louis O. Gifreda and his deputy Frank Salcedo to undertake a secret nationwide, quote, readiness exercise, codenamed Rex 84. This exercise was to test the, quote, readiness of the Federal Emergency Management Agency to exercise civilian supervisory authority over Defense Department personnel, the personnel of all 50 state National Guard units and numerous state-based, quote, State Defense Force units, which were to be established at the behest of FEMA by state legislative enactments. In the event that President Reagan chose to declare a state of domestic national emergency, concurrent with the launching of a direct United States military operation into Central America, this military operation was to be codenamed, quote, Operation Night Train. According to source number 4, the mission of the FEMA operation was to be tested pursuant to this Rex 84 readiness exercise. This purpose was twofold. The mission was twofold. First, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, after, quote, deputizing all Department of Defense personnel and state National Guard personnel, ostensibly so as to make such personnel civilians and to thereby avoid violating the congressionally enacted Posse Comitatus Act, the FEMA would then undertake to test its ability to seek out and take into custody some 400,000 undocumented Central American aliens throughout the United States, and then to intern said Central American aliens in 10 military detention centers to be established during this Rex 84 readiness exercise at 10 U.S. military bases throughout the United States. These undocumented Central American aliens were to be held at these detention centers during any real emergency, any real such presidentially deemed state of domestic national emergency, without the right of habeas corpus until President Reagan declared the state of national emergency to be at an end. The second mission of the FEMA operation to be tested pursuant to this Rex 84 readiness exercise was the distribution by FEMA from U.S. military bases under the supervision of United States Department of Defense through the state National Guard units down into the hands of civilian state legislature-created state defense forces of hundreds of tons of small arms and ammunition, ostensibly to be used by their civilian domestic law enforcement, quote, deputies to enforce domestic laws during the pending of the presidentially declared state of national emergency.
Skipping down a little bit in the Sheehan affidavit, during the third week of April of 1984, source number 7 obtained for me an introduction to source number 8, a member of the legal division of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the office headed up by FEMA General Counsel George Delt, D-E-L-T. Source number 8, who was known by source number 7 to be an honest and trustworthy source of information based upon source number 7's direct experience with him, was shocked that I had such accurate information concerning the content of Presidential National Security Decision Directive number 52. But he expressly confirmed the accuracy of the intelligence report given to me by source number 4 concerning the twofold mission of Rex 84. Source number 8 expressed directly to me a high degree of fear and anxiety about the legality of what was being planned by FEMA General Counsel George Jett, J-E-T-T, FEMA Director Louis O. Giuffrida, G-I-U-F-F-R-I-D-A, and FEMA Deputy Director Frank Salcedo, S-A-L-C-E-D-O. Source number 8 reported to me that he had never before seen inside FEMA such an intense level of security concerning any program. Source number 8 reported to me that FEMA General Counsel George Jett had ordered the installation of a special metal security door into the hallway on the fifth floor of the FEMA building in Washington, D.C., behind which door all of the planning for Rex 84 was being conducted. Indeed, source number 8 reported to me that even long-standing employees of the Civil Defense Division of the Federal Executive Department, possessing the highest possible security clearances, were not being allowed through the newly installed metal security door on the fifth floor of the FEMA building to have access to the planning of Rex 84. Source number 8 reported that only FEMA Director Louis O. Giuffrida, his Deputy Director Frank Salcedo, FEMA General Counsel George Jett, and a few other men whom source number 8 noticed all wore a small, red Christian cross or crucifix pin on the lapel of their suits, were even allowed through the metal security doors on the fifth floor of the FEMA building to have access to Rex 84 information. Through a source number 9, I was able to obtain a series of federal documents from inside FEMA which tend to confirm the above-reported description of the FEMA activities reported to me during April of 1984.